You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Welcome once again to Cool Stuff Ride Home. I'm Marcus Papp. He's Reggie Rizzou. On today's episode, there's now a debate over the intelligence of the Tyrannosaurus Rex. Can't wait to hear the details on this one. A dog lost in Australia reunites with his UK-based owners. And on this day in history, the ice cream cone becomes an American staple. That's all coming up on Cool Stuff.
There is now some debate on the intelligence of Tyrannosaurus Rex, with recent claims suggesting they may have been smart as monkeys. However, a new study challenges those assertions, proposing that T-Rex and other theropod dinosaurs likely possessed intelligence more akin to modern crocodiles than primates. The initial argument stemmed from a paper released in December of 2022 in the journal Comparative Neurology by neurologist Susanna Herculano-Huzel, which claims that theropods had neuron counts comparable to monkeys, implying advanced cognitive abilities. She said with the monkey-like number of neurons, it, quote, would make these animals not only giant, but also long-lived and endowed with flexible cognition, end quote. However, an opposing team of researchers challenged this view in a paper published this week in the Anatomical Record, which included paleontologists, neuroscientists, and behavioral scientists. They are asserting that theropod dinosaurs probably had, quote, significantly lower neuron counts than previously proposed, end quote. They added that the neuron count and relative brain size are flawed proxies for measuring ancient animals' intelligence and other aspects of their biologies. The opposing study's lead author, Kai Casper, a biologist at Heinrich Heine University in Dusseldorf, said, quote, we argue that it's not good practice to predict intelligence in extinct species where neuron counts reconstructed from endocasts are all we have to go on, end quote. Casper did add, what needs to be emphasized is that reptiles are certainly not as dim-witted as commonly believed. So whereas there is no reason to assume that T-Rex had primate-like habits, it is certainly a behavioral sophisticated animal, end quote. The study pointed out that giraffes have the same number of neurons as crows and baboons, but they don't display the same complex social behavior or use tools. One of the main challenges in assessing the intelligence of dinosaurs comes from the fact that dinosaur organs, which include the brain, don't preserve well when you're looking at them tens of millions of years later. While dinosaur skin fossils exist, internal organs such as brains are rarely found intact. As a result, scientists must rely on alternative methods to gauge the cognitive capabilities of these ancient creatures. Now, Herculano-Huzel's study used existing data on neuron counts in modern sauropsids, which includes birds and squamates, and used this information to estimate the cognitive capabilities of dinosaurs and pterosaurs. She told the LA Times, quote, I am delighted to see that my simple study using solid data published by paleontologists opened the way for new studies. Readers should analyze the evidence and draw their own conclusions. That's what science is all about, end quote. Darren Naish, a paleontologist at the University of Southampton and co-author of the challenging paper, said, quote, the possibility that T-Rex might have been as intelligent as a baboon is fascinating and terrifying, with the potential to reinvent our view of the past. But our study shows how all the data we have is against this idea. They were more like smart giant crocodiles, and that's just as fascinating, end quote. Now, the animal kingdom has a diverse array of intelligent species. While some animals, including reptiles, demonstrate tool use and self-awareness, the absence of living specimens can make it challenging to accurately assess the intelligence of extinct creatures like T-Rex. I don't know about you, Marcus, but the idea of a smart T-Rex would actually terrify me. I mean, a dumb creature attacking me, I at least would think I could outsmart. A creature that has some intelligence attacking me, that would freak me out. I'm glad I don't live around smart T-Rexes.
Well, yeah. I mean, definitely. Thank God we don't live around a dumb T-Rex, a smart T-Rex. I just don't want to live around T-Rexes. And I get what the scientists are saying. Oh, it's a terrifying thought. But thankfully, we do not have to be terrified because as far as I know, nobody has brought any of these creatures back to life. None of them have been hiding out, staking out anywhere for the last few million years. So I think we're okay in regardless of how intelligent this particular beast was. But I do think look, and I don't have the scientific background probably to be commenting on this, but it just seems a little outlandish to me to go back and try to assess how intelligent a creature was that lived that long ago and for which there are no living specimens. There's not even a preserved brain of some kind to be able to go in and study. So I can appreciate to an extent the fact that scientists are trying to use clues as best they can to figure stuff like this out. But in my mind anyway, just being the skeptical viewer or consumer in this case, I think you have to take it all with a grain of salt and be cognizant of the fact that they really don't have much to go on when trying to make these best guesses, I suppose, is maybe the proper way to characterize it.
So are you telling me we need to have a real life Jurassic Park and figure these answers out?
That's what you took from that? No, yes, yes.
That's exactly what
yes,
I took.
Yes, that is what I'm saying. I think that's the direction we need to go. Somebody find me an island and I will observe from afar. You know what? Let's set up cameras and I'll watch the live web stream. I don't think I want to be there to experience this firsthand, put it that way.
Make sure you have faulty cages and corrupt individuals working for you to make sure they can escape.
Who insured that park, by the way? Did anybody stop out and say, you know what? This looks like it's up to code and safe. Let's welcome millions of people to this island, this inescapable island, while, as you put it, crooked individuals working there, faulty cages, all that stuff. Not well thought out.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Moving on to a feel-good story for the animal lovers out there. Not talking about T-Rex in this instance, but Milo the dog, who went missing in Australia for more than 2 weeks. He's been reunited with his owners in the United Kingdom. No, Milo didn't hop a plane or a ship to Australia on his own. He'd been visiting with his owners, Jason Watnall and Nick Rollins, but escaped the pair at the Melbourne airport shortly before they were set to return home. Per Sky News, the 5.5-year-old canine then went on a bit of an adventure, spending 17 days on the loose in the Melbourne suburbs before finally being found. Watnall told Sky News he was brought to tears when he was reunited with his beloved Milo. Quote, "It was just amazing to get Milo back. He was like squealing with delight, so excited. And I cried, everyone cried, so it was really emotional. And then we just hung out with him," end quote. As you can imagine, both Watnall and Rollins had grown increasingly concerned for Milo's well-being while they were home on the other side of the world. Per Watnall, quote, "For 12 days, we didn't have any sightings. We didn't know where he was, so it was quite dismal, losing hope a bit. Thankfully for Milo, a social media appeal led to a number of tips from volunteers." Said Watnall, quote, "We started having sightings come in left, right, and center from people in the area who kept spotting him. So we ended up pinpointing where he was, and they laid the trap, and probably 48 hours later, they had him. It was a crazy ordeal. Most dogs get found within 48 hours, so 17 days of being on the other side of the world, I couldn't have done it without the community and the volunteers and basically all the people that helped," end quote. Of course, Watnall said he was pleased it was a good news story and that he was looking forward to, quote, "getting on with life now and settling into Wales," end quote. And as we like to say on this show, cool stuff, Reg.
So the dog just wanted to go on a little walkabout? Is that what happened here? The fact that he ran away from the owner? He's like, I'm going to travel the Australian desert for 17 days.
Maybe some flight anxiety. You know, you're at the airport and he's like, nope, can't do it. Not doing this again. That's a long trip home. I hate it up there. And you know what? Decided to extend his vacation a little bit. I've said this before. I'm obviously an animal lover. I have a couple of dogs myself. I can't imagine losing one in a foreign country and then being able to go home on the other side of the world. I mean, hours and hours and hours away by plane and then just hope for the best. That had to have been pretty gut-wrenching for these people.
Yeah, although I have to say, if I'm a dog, and obviously dogs can't think like humans, to go on a plane for that distance or be stuck in the Australian desert with some of the weird, crazy, deadly animals that are out there, I'm going on the plane.
Well, it sounds like he was in the Melbourne suburbs, so he wasn't in the outback roaming around, you know, by himself, fending off kangaroos and snakes and all that.
Now that's kind of disappointing. I was imagining him having a kangaroo friend. They went on a little adventure.
Did you listen to the story at all?
I was daydreaming about him having his little adventures and a little movie about it.
This is not Milo and Otis. This is Milo Goes to Melbourne.
Say his name was Milo. He was a lost dog. There should be a movie.
That's right. Otis does not get a starring role in this picture.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Taking a look at this date in history, on April 30th, 1904, the ice cream cone made its debut at the St. Louis World's Fair. Seems fitting that it would be at a fair. Before this, vendors would sell ice cream in glass cups or dishes, which they would call penny licks. Customers were then expected to return them, and they would be rinsed and reused. However, at the St. Louis World's Fair, a 16-year-old immigrant from Syria named Ernest Hamwi was selling zalabia, a kind of waffle, but started making the waffle cones instead when the ice cream booth next to him ran out of the penny licks. That way people could enjoy the ice cream with his cones instead. The St. Louis Globe Democrat described it as, quote, an inverted cone of hard cake resembling a coiled up waffle, end quote. Decades later, Hemway was quoted saying, this idea seemed to go over big, and soon the ice cream concessions all over the fair purchased the rolled waffles from us and sold them with the cream and called them cornucopias. After the fair, Hemway started a job with Cornucopia Waffle Oven Company as a traveling salesman until 1910, when he started his own ice cream cone business. However, there are some disputes on when the ice cream cone originated. An Italian immigrant in New York City named Italo Marchioni patented a mold that would make 10 cones at once in 1903 and claims he had served ice cream that way since 1896. But, you know, it was at the World's Fair where it was made a popular novelty. And because of that, the ice cream cone became Missouri's official state dessert. Now, the ice cream cone wasn't the only food people had for the first time at the fair. Food historian Elizabeth Abbott said people attending the World's Fair got their first taste of what are now American staples. Things like hot dogs and hamburgers, puffed rice, cotton candy, and peanut butter, plus Jell-O samples were given away as well. Now, these foods were invented before the fair, but this was the first time many of them were able to test them. Abbott said the 1904 World's Fair, quote, changed how the Western world ate and snacked, end quote.
Interesting. Fair enough. I suppose, you know, you're distributing these things en masse. And at that time, a lot of these food items probably not readily available in large parts of the country. I've never heard of puffed rice, though. Is that a thing that a lot of people consume?
Think of cereal, Rice Krispies would be considered puffed rice. Yeah, Rice Krispie treats, you know, things like that. Puffed rice, you just kind of puff the rice, I guess, you know, and cotton candy.
Is that what you do?
you puff it. You puff the rice and you eat it.
Okay. I mean, doesn't sound all that appealing to me, I'll be honest, unless there's some marshmallowy goodness there keeping it all together. What's the point?
What I found funny with cotton candy, according to the story I was reading, a lot of people refused to eat it until they were convinced that it wasn't actually made out of cotton. So
I believe that. I mean, you look at it and it certainly does resemble that, although if you put your hand in it, it's quite sticky. So
yeah, I didn't realize Jell-O samples were handed out that early either. That was a big day for Jell-O, I guess.
When was Jell-O first conceived of? That would be an interesting story for this here podcast.
According to Wikipedia, the source of all knowledge in the world, Pearl Bigsby Waite trademarked the name Jell-O in 1897, but actually the flavoring, the, I guess, gelatin structure was actually patented in 1845. So the Jell-O, I guess, concept was 1845. The name Jell-O came out in 1897.
Well, if we can't trust your haphazard Google search while doing a podcast, I don't know what we can trust. So
hey,
there you have it. The history of Jell-O.
Not where I expected us to go when I talked about the ice cream cone, but here we are.
Folks, get a second source on this. I'm just throwing that out there. Don't go taking that to the bank, the history of Jell-O.
All right. Thanks for joining us on this edition of Cool Stuff Ride Home. I'm not taking your downplaying of my intelligence in Google search.
I didn't downplay your intelligence at all.
You're calling me an idiot.
Just the crude search. Wrap it up.
All right. If you have any corrections you want to make with Jell-O or anything else, you can reach us at coolstuffcommute@gmail.com. Also, like us and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. I'm Reggie Rizzou. He's Marcus Path. We'll be back with more cool stuff tomorrow.